On the corner of the road, not very far from where I live, over the last, I suppose it's been 12 months now, they've been renovating a bungalow. This bungalow was lived in by an elderly lady who was in Oadby when we first moved there, back in 1976. And she died just over 12 months ago, and somebody bought this bungalow and decided to renovate it. So what they've been doing is they've knocked down some parts of it, knocked one or two walls out, and then extended it. And they had to renew part of the roof. So the picture is this, that they've been working on this bungalow. Some of the old bungalow remains, some of the original structure and rooms are there, but then others have been taken away and other parts have been added on. And it struck me that that was quite a good illustration of the kind of thing that you, as two fellowships, are engaged in here as you seek God's will to come together as one group. There'll be things from both churches in your history that you'll want to keep. And then there'll be other things that both churches are prepared to say, well, okay, we'll do away with that. And then there'll be new aspects to your work as well. So in a sense, you're rather like this renovated bungalow, or you will be when you're finished, on the corner of the road. And in a way, Nehemiah was involved in a similar project once again. The walls of Jerusalem had been broken down round about 600 and something BC by Nebuchadnezzar with his invading forces. They came back again and the temple was destroyed and burnt down. The gates of the city had been burned down. And the place needed a tremendous amount of renovation. About 160 years had gone by since the Babylonian invasion, and the exiles had been taken to Babylon and enslaved, including this guy named Nehemiah. Not that he was alive then, of course, but he was born as a servant, born into a family whereby he became a servant, a slave, really, of the king Artaxerxes in the city of Susa in the Babylonian Empire. But then something in the region of 100 years or 90-something years, a group of exiles went back again under the leadership of a guy named Zerubbabel, and they laid the foundations of another temple and started rebuilding the temple. And then 13 years before Nehemiah, a guy by the name of Ezra also went to Jerusalem from Babylon and continued the work. And so you get the book of Ezra, which immediately precedes this book of Nehemiah. Why did Nehemiah undertake this project? Well, he undertook the project because he was deeply grieved by the disgraced state of the people living in a very sparsely populated, ruined city. You read about that in chapter 1. And therefore he sought God, confessing sin and seeking God for what should be done. And so he planned the project to rebuild and renovate the walls of Jerusalem. And the day came when the king agreed to him being able to go. And we've got all that in chapter 1 and at the beginning of chapter 2. And so Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem, and we read that in verses 11 and 12 of chapter 2, and that's where I want to take up the account of what we've got here. And notice one or two things about this renovating and rebuilding project, which I hope may be of some relevance and help to you here today. You notice in the first place, verses 12 to 16 of chapter 2, that Nehemiah assessed the task. He assessed the task. Remember that up to now, prior to his arrival in Jerusalem, Nehemiah had only heard stories about what the situation was, particularly from his brother Hananiah and a few others that had come from Jerusalem to Susa and told him the situation. So up to now, he only knew it second hand. And he could only imagine what the situation was like. Nehemiah was born in Babylon, in the empire. He'd never been to Jerusalem. And in fact, for some generations, he wouldn't have known anybody who did remember Jerusalem, other than the odd visitor now and then. And it would seem from chapter 1 that he'd had no real news until his brother Hanani came and saw him and told him about the broken down state and the disgraceful state of the city. And that caused Nehemiah great grief, but he could only imagine it. He could only imagine it. And so therefore, when he arrives in the city, the first thing he does is take a first-hand assessment of the situation before he even begins to share what's on his heart and mind. He needed to know exactly what was going to be entailed in this project. And so he goes out. He goes out by night so as not to draw attention to himself and to what he's doing. Only a few folks are with him. And he goes out on a donkey to start with, and then he goes on foot up the Kidron Valley between the Mount of Olives and the eastern entrance to Jerusalem. Probably a very moonlit night, and he's assessing the state of the walls as he goes along. So he knows exactly what the situation is. He doesn't go all the way round the city. He goes until he's seen enough to be satisfied that he is clearly aware of what this task entails. But he kept his conclusions and his plans to himself for the time being. He actually says in verse 16, "As yet I said nothing to the Jews, or the priests, or the nobles, or the officials, or anybody else." And notice they're very clever about the work that they would be doing. He didn't want to tell them too soon in case they all did a runner on him, you see. So he wanted to make sure he got all his facts straight, wanted to make sure he got all his plans laid, and then he could share it with them until he was ready to start. In other words, Nehemiah didn't do any kite flying. Now, sometimes when you're engaged in a project for God, it's not a bad thing to do a bit of kite flying. Nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean by that, don't you? We've often done it in our church, get a group of folks together and say, "How about this for an idea?" And you float an idea for them and give them the opportunity to kick it around and think about it and pray about it. Sometimes that's not a bad thing to do. There's nothing wrong with that. But that isn't Nehemiah's approach this time. Nehemiah wants to be pretty sure of his facts, clear of his plans, before he goes public. And of course, the secret to good leadership is knowing when to do which. Nehemiah was a good, godly leader, and he had the wisdom to know sometimes you've got to have everything in place in your plan before you can go public. Other times, you can fly your kites. Nehemiah knew that this was going to be a task that would put great demands on the people. We know from later on in the book there weren't many people actually living in Jerusalem. It was sparsely populated. He can start imagining all the objections that he's going to get when he suggests this project to the people. So therefore he's got to do it carefully. He's got to do it in the right way. And he's got to do it at the right time. And so, having assessed the task, then comes the time when he shared the vision. And you see that in verses 17 and 18 of chapter 2. He shared the vision. He actually said to them and told them what was on his heart and mind. It appears from verse 17 that the way in which Nehemiah did this was to call a general meeting. This doesn't seem to have been a private meeting with just a few leaders, because he tells quite a number of them. He says, "I said to them, you see the trouble we're in. and began to share with these people who are mentioned in verse 16, the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and all these others. Now is the time when he goes public with his plans. And he's a very clever leader, because you see, he does this in such a way as to immediately gain their interest, their concern, and their involvement. It's interesting, he doesn't go to them and say to them, "You see the trouble you were in." You notice that? See the trouble you were in? Look at the state of affairs that you confront. He doesn't go in and say, "The king has appointed me governor here and he sent me to tell you lot, it's about time you repaired the walls. It's time you did something about this." No. Notice what he says in verse 17, "Let us rebuild the wall." Nehemiah is committing himself as their governor to this project. And in effect he is saying, "I am committed to this God-given project to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Now, are you going to join me?" That's his approach. That's his approach. That's how he shares his vision. Notice he points out two things to them. He points out the trouble that they are in. "We are in trouble," he says. They obviously were. The city walls were all broken down. They were defenceless. It was dead easy for raiding parties who came through to just come into the city and loot what houses were there. Attack people if they wanted to. It was a troubled and dangerous situation. But you also notice in verse 17, it was a disgraceful situation. Look at the disgrace we're in. This city is lying in ruins now for something like 160 years. And yet this is the place where God's name is supposed to be honoured. This is the place where God's people are supposed to be, glorifying him. And look at the state of the place. All it does is demonstrate the marks of defeat. All it does, it shouts out in loud words, "Look at the state of God's people. They are run down, they are downtrodden, they are in a mess, they are in a state of disgrace. They are defeated, they are under judgment." And it's interesting that Nehemiah actually does tell them this in verse 17. And he tells them this as if they weren't aware of it. And actually, this is why I told the kids earlier this little story about George Muller. Because you see, here's the very situation that's so much the same. Here are a group of people back in Jerusalem. Some of them have been in Jerusalem for about 13 years. Others have been back in Jerusalem for longer than that. And some have been born there and brought up there, and their granddads and their great-granddads and so on and so forth were born and brought up there over the last 160 years, living in and around a ruined city. And very often the problem is that when we are in a situation, especially when we're born into it and brought up in it, we can't see the wood for the trees. And the obvious just doesn't strike us. And it may well be, I'm sure, that there would have been inhabitants in Jerusalem, perhaps the vast majority of them, in that very situation. They went in and out every day, climbing through the broken down walls of Jerusalem, and it never crossed their mind that this place was in trouble, that this was a disgrace. And so Nehemiah challenges them to think about the situation as it is and say to them, "Look, it shouldn't be like this. It shouldn't be like this." But this is the thing he's sharing with them. He isn't simply saying to them, "It shouldn't be like this." What he's actually saying is, "It doesn't have to be like this." And he begins to show them what, not only what should be, but he begins to show them what could be. And so, verse 18, not only does he tell them about the trouble they're in, but then he tells them about the grace that God is willing to give them and share with them. He actually gives his testimony. "I told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me." You see, sometimes we can have good ideas. And you might have been others that at some point in the history of the Babylonian Empire and exile, there might have been others that had the good idea to repair the walls of Jerusalem, maybe. But the question is, not is this a good idea, but is this God's idea? And Nehemiah is able to demonstrate to these people who are in trouble and in disgrace in Jerusalem, look folks, this isn't my bright idea. I haven't come along here on my own back to say it's about time you lot got on with it and repaired the walls. Look folks, this is God's idea. This shouldn't be like this. This can be a renewed city. This is what God wants it to be. And then he says to them, I know that because of the way the king has reacted. Look at what the king has done, he said, and he told them what the king had said to him, and that's all earlier on in chapter 2, and we read it together. You see, God's hand is in this, folks. And therefore, what should be, can be, let's get on with it. So that was Nehemiah's attitude. And it struck me as I've been working on this book of Nehemiah, that in some ways, maybe many of us, and I'm talking about evangelical, Bible-believing people, it may well be that many of us today are somewhat like those residents of old broken down Jerusalem. And it is this, that we just don't realise the crisis that we're in. We're just not aware of the trouble that we're in. And the disgrace that's upon us. In about 2006, there was a survey done of church life in the UK. And it was across all denominations, including groups like ours. But they drew these conclusions, that if church life in the UK continues as it is now, by 2050, in 40 years' time, the number of Christians attending a place of worship will be less than 1 million. That's about 1/60th of our population. Meanwhile, there will be almost 1 million Hindus attending their gurdwaras and their temples. So there'll be as many Hindus going to their temples as there will be Christians going to churches within the next 40 years. But at the same time, there will be three times as many Muslims as there are Christians going to mosques. If things go as they are, there'll be something like almost 3 million Muslims going to mosques on a Friday, compared to 1 million Christians going to church on a Sunday. That means, in practical terms, that eventually, in the lifetime of some of you, it won't be my lifetime, but certainly the lifetime of a number of you, there'll be three times as many mosques in England as there are churches. And people don't realise the crisis we're in. And consequently, in the meantime, in our churches, they are carrying on as they are, as if nothing really is wrong. When I'm tending to travel around a little bit more nowadays, and I do have to say this, and I can only say it, and you'll have to, you don't have to invite me again, but many of our churches I'm seeing are outdated. They are poorly led. They're in decline. And when you try to speak to the leaders gently and carefully, it just seems they have no concept of the trouble that they and we are in. I was at a little fellowship a few weeks ago in a city in another county north of here. And the building, what can you say? It looks as if it was built for George Muller in the 1830s. Inside and out. It's on the edge of an estate, The car park is shut off permanently, completely. So the message is, whatever you do, don't bring your car down here. The reason that the car park is all shut off is because it was used as a local rubbish dump until recently. So they decided, rather than let people fly to pull their rubbish, they'd close the gates. Little tiny group of them. And I'm sitting there trying to think, well, how can we help? How can we encourage? And the leader said to me, oh, but we've got a lovely little fellowship here. They do have a lovely little fellowship. But if that is the full extent of their horizon, they really are in trouble. And there are lots of churches in our country like that. Now, as I say, I'm not coming to criticise you folks. As I say, it's been years since I was at Belton Street, so I don't know your situation. And certainly, I know that that isn't true at Kirk Hill. I'm just trying to give you a general picture of the kind of thing I'm seeing around the country. And what worries me is that us Christians have got little concept of the trouble and the disgrace we're in, and consequently, we have no plans to address the problem. What are we doing most of the time? Just carry on as we are. God commissioned us to evangelise and disciple the world. And frankly, most of us can't even evangelise and disciple our own families, let alone the world. Makes you think, doesn't it? So Nehemiah shared the vision of the trouble they were in and said to them, look, it shouldn't be like this. And because of the grace of God, it can be different. And so, verse 18 through chapter 3, they began the good work. Let's have some good news now, shall we? We've had the bad news. Let's put that to bed. Let's have some good news. They began the good work. And it's great to just read them. We're not going to do it because we haven't got time. But it's great to read down through chapter 3. Now, I don't know whether you're one of these people, you read through a chapter like chapter 3, it's got lots and lots and lots of names in it, lots and lots of details, and you tend to think to yourself, how boring. You know, when you come across that in your daily readings, you think, oh, let's get through this chapter. You know, do I have to read it? Well, there's a great message, some great messages in chapter 3 of Nehemiah. You notice the broad range of people who committed themselves to do this work. They came from all kinds of places. It wasn't just the people who lived in Jerusalem, of which there weren't very many. They came up from Jericho and Tekoa and from Gibeon and Mizpah, you read in the early verses of chapter 3. The top leaders set a good example. They got involved in the work. And they weren't just there to read the plans and tell people what to do. They got their hands dirty. They got stuck in, including the high priest, you read in chapter 3 and verse 1. And other priests, and then priests from the surrounding regions came in to help as well. A broad range of people started committing themselves to this work. You notice in verse 8 and verse 31 of chapter 3, the artist craftsmen got involved. Now these are the goldsmiths and the silversmiths and the people with you. Oh, their hands were tender. They'd never been used to mixing cement and honking stones and bricks around and so on and so forth. And you could well imagine that. You could well imagine their excuse. My fingers are too tender for this. No, get stuck in, they did. Remarkable. And then you notice the local mayors got stuck in. You read that in verses 9 and 18. Even the high up dignitaries of the local leaders, they came and gave a hand. Some of their daughters, the ladies, got stuck in. The teachers and the lawyers, the Levites, chapter 3, verse 17. But most of this chapter is a list of people that you and I have no knowledge about whatsoever. They're just names on a page. But they all did their bit. They all got involved. Most of them were not famous. Most of them were not highly skilled or clever. Most of them, it seems to me, were pretty ordinary folks, and you may class yourself like that, and certainly I do. But they did their bit. And you notice they didn't all do the same thing. As you read through chapter 3, you'll find some built large sections of the wall. Some just built a little bit outside their own houses. Some built walls, some hung gates. Some did both, you'll find. Some, chapter 3, verse 20, served with obvious zeal. Others, sad to say, didn't really put their shoulders to the work, as we read in chapter 3 and verse 5. Isn't that typical of church life? All over, really. There are some that are full of enthusiasm, others it's a job to get them in. But they'll do something. Some, you know, seem to be able to do everything, and others can do just a little bit. But they all contributed to the work. And the overall picture is that lovely verse in chapter 4 and verse 6, where he says, "So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their hearts." Okay, there were some exceptions, as we say, but by and large, this is the picture. They put their hearts and their brains and their backs into this project. What a lovely picture of people serving God. And I've no doubt that as two fellowships, you've been discussing how you're going to come together and so on. You'll have had people already, some of you were full of enthusiasm, others of you not so keen. That's life. Okay, that's how it is. Some of you have been at the forefront of this project to bring your two churches together. Others of you have, well, that's not been your scene. You've been coming along and you're happy to know what's going on. And yeah, and you're doing your bit, but you're not out front. You're not leading the project and so on. But that's okay. You're doing what you can. Everybody can contribute to this good work. Don't feel that when these churches come together, that's you finished. Far from it. Far from it. We can all contribute. We can all get involved. But then notice another thing in chapter 4 and verse 6, and this goes right through to chapter 6 and verse 14. They persevered through what I'm calling the mid-mission crisis. They persevered through the mid-mission crisis. Notice what it says in verse 4. When they had built the walls to half their height. Now, so far, things seem to have been going pretty well. And projects can be like that, can't they? You start off and you've got the vision for it, you've got the enthusiasm for it, and on you go. But then there comes a point when problems start to arise. And we are told what some of these problems are. Verses 7 and 8, there was opposition. Sanballat and Tobiah and so on. Now we've come across them before, if you read the earlier part of Nehemiah. There have been rumblings by the enemies ever since the project started. But now it becomes very evident. Now it becomes outright and upfront. The opposition from the enemies. And the work is seriously threatened. You also find here that the people start to get weary. Verse 10, the people in Judah said, "The strength of the labourers is giving out." And that happens, doesn't it? You start to get weary. I'm doing a project in my back garden at the minute. And yesterday, a friend of mine who'd got some paving slabs that they didn't want delivered 8 paving slabs to me. And we were discussing what I'm doing, you see, in the garden. And I just happened to say to this person, who's a good bit younger than me, I said, "I've learnt the secret now to do it a bit at a time." You see? Now, the person who delivered in the slabs said, "Oh, no, no, I like to get on with it." And I said to him, "But you're not as old as me." Because what do you discover? You discover you get tired, don't you? You get tired quicker. So what do I want to do when I've had my dinner? Get out in the garden, lay slabs? No, I want to put my feet up and have a kip. No, because I get tired. It's life. It's part of life. And that's what was happening here. They were beginning to get tired. And it wasn't just a daily thing. They were beginning to get tired because they'd stuck at it now for some while. And it had been tough, it wasn't easy. And another problem you see there in verse 10, there's so much rubble. They got to a point where now the old wall, which had been broken down and just left lying around, they got to the point now where all this stuff was in the way. So that was hindering the work. So that was another problem. And then on top of this, verses 11 and 12, along come the doom merchants. The It'll Never Work Brigade. They came along. They were picking up what the enemies were saying. The enemies were saying, we'll soon put a stop to this. And then the doom merchants come along and say, you know what so-and-so says, don't you? You know what they think? This will never, you'll never get this done. It's a waste of time, this is. I don't know. Please, don't imagine that Simon Clark's been talking to me about this, because he hasn't. But I wouldn't be surprised if there weren't some, at some point in this project to bring your two churches together, and they've come along to you and they've said, it'll never work. Now, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if, it'd be great if there was nobody from either church like that, but I just got that deep down feeling, because I've lived long enough to know what human nature's like, I'm like it myself, who's come along and said, it ain't going to work, you know, this, it's a waste of time. No wonder if people have been saying that to you, the doom merchants. And then if you go on into chapter 5, you'll find there was some internal strife over debts and oppression and so on. I don't suppose that's a problem here, but differences begin to show up as the project gets going and it's part way through. Then differences of view and opinion, and people start saying, I didn't think it was going to be like this. I didn't think that's what it was supposed to. I thought it would be so-and-so. And so you begin to get divisions occur, as they have to face in chapter 5, if you take the trouble to read it. And then the leaders themselves get attacked, and you see that in the first half of chapter 6. We haven't got time to stop with all this now. But the leaders get attacked. It's important for the leaders to keep their nerve. Nehemiah himself was being tempted to compromise and to ease off. The mid-mission crisis, you almost always get it in any project of God's work. You start off and then things crop up that you hadn't foreseen. George Muller starts off with his orphanages, he's got four homes going in Wilson Street. He never thought about the drains. Well, you wouldn't, would you? He never thought about the drains until they became a problem. And then somebody had to tell him, I hadn't thought of that. That's bound to happen. And if it hasn't happened already, it certainly will. In fact, my good brother was telling me this morning, just in the room at the back, that you've run into questions now about the legality of the two churches. And I hope I'm not telling anything I shouldn't say here, brother. He's looking at me very passively. I don't know whether I'm allowed to say anything at this point. Am I allowed just to say? Do everybody know? They do, right. That they've got one lawyer who's advising you that one, the law says one thing, and you've got another lawyer advising you that the law says another. That's very helpful from lawyers, isn't it? You've hit a mid-mission crisis. It may not be a big one, but you've hit one. It's come up. I'll bet you hadn't thought of that, had you? But here it is. So what are you going to do? Well, the challenge is, of course, to ditch the whole thing or press on. What are you going to do? Well, Nehemiah certainly knew what he was going to do with his mid-mission crisis. It was to press on with the work, to face the challenge and to keep on with the good work. Why? Because he knew this was God's work and God was supplying their grace. So although the problems come and you can expect them, that doesn't mean to say, A, that the project is wrong and B, that it can't be done. And so the good work began. But the great thing to finish off is, chapter 6 and verse 15, they completed the project. They completed the project. You see it there in chapter 6 and verse 15. It's quite a remarkable statement. So the wall was completed on the 25th day of Elul. In 52 days, they completed this work. That's good going. 7.5 weeks to finish the job. And notice Nehemiah's testimony in verse 16 of chapter 6. When he was able to tell their enemies about this, and the enemies lost their confidence because they realized this work had been done with the help of our God. And there's the secret. With the help of our God. Why did the early church turn the world upside down? Because it tells us in the book of Acts, the Lord working with them. The Lord working with them. And all through this project, Nehemiah is able to say, the gracious hand of the Lord was upon me and upon his great project. We're in a crisis, I would suggest, in this country, spiritually speaking. It shouldn't be like this, not with our heritage. Not with the heritage of the gospel we've had in this land all these centuries. It shouldn't be like this. But dear friends, I honestly believe it doesn't have to be like this. What we need to see afresh is the gracious hand of our God upon us. And remember this. It's very important. That in your project to bring your two churches together, you have to keep in mind the much bigger picture. There's a much bigger picture than just bringing two churches together. The book of Nehemiah demonstrates that. It's a much bigger thing in Nehemiah than rebuilding or renovating the walls. Why should there be all these chapters about a few people, most of whom we have no idea who they are? Why should the Bible devote all this time to all of this? Why didn't the Bible say in three verses, there was a guy by the name of Nehemiah, the king sent him to Jerusalem, he gathered a group around him, they built the walls, stop. Why all this information? Because there's a big thing going on here. What's the big thing? The big thing is that God is preparing an honourable and a suitable place in order to send his Son into the world for the Saviour, to be the Saviour of sinners the whole world over in every age. Jesus was going to come to this city. This is the city just outside this very wall that Nehemiah was rebuilding, that he's going to offer himself a sacrifice for sinners on a cross. This city has got to be populated. This city has got to be an honourable place. This city has got to be house the home that is the house of prayer for God. This is my Father's house, a house of prayer. This is where Jesus is going to come. This is about the eternal kingdom of God. This is all part of the great work of redemption. And the bricks in the walls at Jerusalem were simply a brick in the redemptive history of God for the whole world for time and eternity. It fits the big picture. And you need to keep that in mind as two churches come together. You've got to fit the big picture. What's the big picture? The big picture is strengthening the witness of the gospel in Shepshed. The big picture is reaching the people of this town. And if as bringing two churches together, nothing of that is affected, then you are wasting your time. If you're not going to result, if the result of bringing your two churches together is not stronger witness to this town, and reaching out to the souls of this town in a far more effective way than you can now, then you may as well not bother. Because that's the big picture. Remember, you're not doing this for you. You're doing this for them. Are you? That's what it really needs to be all about. And it seems to me that's the good work that God has put into your hands. And he will give you his grace to complete it.